Today on Against the Grain. Capitalism by its nature produces crises, and for the last century, states have responded by imposing austerity measures on the public. Governments claim it's a bitter but necessary medicine to set economies back on track. But economist Clara Mattei argues that austerity is actually a bludgeon to entrench elite power and repress workers' aspirations for a more egalitarian society. She looks at its origins, and that of modern economics, during the greatest existential threat to the capitalist order. Today on Against the Grain. Capitalism by its nature produces crises, and for the last century, states have responded by imposing austerity measures on the public. Governments claim it's a bitter but necessary medicine to set economies back on track. But economist Clara Mattei argues that austerity is actually a bludgeon to entrench elite power and repress workers' aspirations for a more egalitarian society. She looks at its origins, and that of modern economics, during the greatest existential threat to the capitalist order. Capitalism produces crisis, and imposing austerity measures on the public has become the default response. And during this hour, we'll discuss how that became the default. But I wonder if you could describe for us what we're talking about when we say austerity. You write that whenever it takes place in the world these days, austerity is highly predictable. What does it look like?
Austerity is a tricky word because we rarely hear it, even if it pervades our lives very, very deeply. And the reason why we don't hear the word is because it has now a negative connotation after the profound suffering that pervaded also the developed countries after the 2008 crisis. So austerity not only is never used, it's also misdefined when it is used. In fact, if you look at a definition on any dictionary, you will read that austerity is about budget cuts and tax increases. Now, in my historical work, I show how this definition is empty because it is not able to really focus on what matters, which is not so much that the state cuts spending, but that it cuts social spending. And so the question is, where does the state cut? And we see that it cuts social spending in favor of huge subsidies to large corporations, huge incentives to the military expenditure, surveillance, and incarceration. While at the same time, it's not just about raising taxes, it's about regressive taxation. Again, who is the state taxing? And what you see in the United States, as everywhere in the world, that labor, it bears the brunt of taxation much more than capital. Those who make, in other words, those who make money off of dividend and interest and rent pay far less taxes than those who actually work for a wage, to the point that even Warren Buffett had to admit that his secretary was paying much more taxes than he was. So austerity is about cuts in social expenditures to shift resources in favor of the wealthy private investors. And it's about cutting taxes on the rich while overly taxing the poor and the working classes. This is the first element, which is fiscal austerity. Then, of course, we have what happens at the level of monetary policies. And austerity is all about increasing interest rates, usually, which again hurts working class, common people much more, because when you bring interest rates up, what this means is that you're making money more expensive, which means that those who do have the money to lend are benefiting very much, right? And also banks and financial institutions are getting a huge gains when borrowing becomes more expensive because they are the ones lending the money. While those who live off of credit cards, especially in America, the majority of working class people have to pay more. But it's not just about that. It's also about the fact that people lose their jobs. As we know, recently the Fed has increased interest rates, and this has had a negative impact willingly so. This is obvious for macroeconomists, that increasing interest rates slows down the economy, meaning that it impacts the labor market and people get laid off or have less job opportunities. So once more, as you pointed out, the crisis is resolved by having people suffer because they have less social services, they pay higher taxes, and then they also have less possibilities of getting a job, to the point that in the United States today, we know that one out of two full-time workers in the United States don't make enough to meet their basic needs. So this precarization, this low wages, is the effect of austerity policies. And the third element of austerity that I study is what I call industrial austerity, that goes with fiscal and monetary austerity. That's why I call it the austerity trinity. And industrial austerity is all about, again, punishing workers by defeating unions, by privatizing, by taking away all the labor protections, right? The deregulation of the labor market with the idea that wages should become eternally flexible, especially flexible downward. So this is the trinity of austerity that, again, has very little to do with actually balancing the budget, and all to do with putting the pressure of our violent economic forces on people so that they're more disciplined to behave as good workers that accept low wages and go work and get exploited by their bosses. Nothing to do with the virtuosity of living within our means, all to do with a classist attempt to maintain the discipline of the working classes. And clearly, the last budgetary measures of this current government show it very well. The big, beautiful bill will be very expensive, over $4 trillion in the next decade, while people will lose food stamps, health coverage, and a lot of the basic, very meager social services that this country provides.
I think you started to allude to it, but is it fair to say that when we talk about austerity and think about austerity, we shouldn't think of it in sort of narrow technical terms, but that by imposing all of these changes and conditions on people, that it undercuts their collective social power?
Absolutely. That is exactly the point of the historical research I've done in my book, The Capital Order, is to say that we cannot understand austerity if we understand it as a technical measure to fix a technical object that supposedly is this economy. This narrowing of our understanding of what our economy is part of the problem. Technocrats and expert economists want us to think that the economy is somehow this natural, neutral object that only they have the power to understand and touch. Well, the whole point of critical economics is to show that the economy, wealth, capital, is actually based on specific social relations, especially of production, by which the majority is structurally disempowered to participate in a way that is actually democratic in the production process. So the social relations are grounding our economy. And in fact, the economy is us. And this is a fundamental intuition that can be very empowering to understand that the economy is not a technical object. It is us, our struggles, our labor, our responsibilities to thus, you know, participate in, first of all, understanding how those measures that experts take, telling us that they are doing something that is neutral and for the good of all, actually many times works to the detriment of the working class people in this country, as everywhere else in the world.
Well, then following along the implications of that, so critics of austerity have pointed out that it rarely achieves its stated goals, you know, the goals to reduce debt, to jumpstart economic growth coming out of an economic recession. So should we conclude, as many have, that austerity just isn't successful? Or do you think that we're just using the wrong measures of success in looking at austerity through just that lens?
Yes, this is a brilliant question. The latter, of course. The point is that if you take a narrow view of the economy, you could understand austerity as fundamentally irrational because it does not produce the growth and, again, the budgetary solutions to our big debt. But this is the whole point, is to say if we have a broader and deeper understanding of austerity, we realize that austerity is not successful in producing growth or balancing the budget, but it is successful in something much more important and essential, and I would even say vital for our capitalist economy, which is the fact that the majority of people cannot escape the capital order, cannot escape this invisible framework that compels us to have no alternative but to go work for a job, and usually a very lousy one with very low pay. So this is the crucial fact, is that this type of economy, again, a capitalist economy, it's not an economy in general, it's a very specific economy that has, you know, a moment of birth and an evolution. In this economy, the subordination of the people is an essential feature. And this is what austerity does so well, is maintained us trapped while the few who benefit from this economy are constantly protected and thus can thrive.
Well, I'd like to turn to the argument that you make in your book, The Capital Order, about how austerity became this common sense, this reflex that we're not even supposed to question, that this is just how things are, and in a crisis, this is what states must do. You situate the origin of that common sense around austerity in the moment of ferment coming out of World War I. And I wonder if you could take us back to that time and begin by talking about how states during World War I intervened in the economy in ways that were unorthodox to that point, and the political and social ramifications of those policies for the public more broadly.
Yes, absolutely. It is the case that the true nature of austerity can be understood and observed if we look historically at when it emerged. And we see that it emerged exactly in a historical moment after the Great War, after the First World War. So in 1918, 1919, in a moment in which our capitalist economy was being questioned very, very deeply. So it was being questioned by those very people, the working people that had suffered during the war, not just in the trenches, but also in the home front, by getting overexploited in order to maintain the productive capacities of these belligerent countries. So in a moment of fundamental existential crisis of capitalism, in which it was clear because of how the state had intervened in an unexpected way in the economy, that things could be different. There was a big challenge of wage labor in itself in favor, for example, of self-management, self-governance, the idea that we could find more democratic ways of organizing production and thus also better objectives than just the profit motive that had ruled the economy until that moment. So it is in this moment in which people themselves embodied these alternatives. I look at Britain and Italy to say, you know, the crisis was happening in the heart of Western capitalism in 1919, 1920, in which indeed all these experiments for post-capitalist alternatives were being taken very seriously, even by the British Parliament, very interestingly. So self-management, nationalization, the economy of need rather than the economy of profit were all in the air and were actually scaring the bourgeoisie and the ruling classes that had benefited from an unjust economic system until that moment. In fact, in Italy, the peak of the scare was the occupation of the factories and the countryside by peasants and workers who were now organized through councils. And that was a moment in which even the head of the government had to say, well, you know what, we can't do much. They're just the majority and they want an economic change. We will need to, you know, accept. And that's when even Giovanni Agnelli, who was the head of the Fiat factory, the automobile factory in Italy, had to say, you know, maybe I will be willing to transform my business into a cooperative because this is the only option I have, basically, to to maintain the viability of my business. So in this existential moment, what you say is very important is that the austerity reaction was extremely successful in refurbishing this order that was collapsing. And how did that operate? Well, it operated through many mechanisms, but I would say we could at least see two of them. One is the austerity trinity that we just described. So the fact that in Europe and, for example, so under fascist Italy, so Benito Mussolini, a very good implementer of the austerity trinity. So cuts in social expenditures, big attacks on unions, making unions and strikes illegal, repressing wages, increasing interest rates so that the unemployment went to the roof. These were very important measures to kill the bargaining power and the expectations for a different future that had emerged during this so-called two red years. On the other hand, there's also the issue of what type of economics became the one that was best apt to impose and protect the capital order. And what we see is the emergence of current day mainstream economics, what still students today study in their textbooks when they take an economics class. This type of economics was specifically targeted towards disempowering the workers by saying value, wealth does not come from workers, it comes from those entrepreneurs who have been virtuous enough to save, and thus we all rely on the few, the entrepreneurs who should be detaxed, who should be incentivized, and who should be protected by the state because they are the engine of the economic machine, not the workers who are just parasites, who are just lazy, and who should instead be disciplined. And of course, austerity was meant exactly to do that, and it did it quite well.
Political economist Clara Mattei is my guest. She's the author of The Capital Order, How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So as you say, you write about the imposition of austerity in two very different countries, Britain, a liberal democracy, and Italy, which in 1922 became a fascist state. And I wonder if we could stay with Britain first. You know, I think for listeners, you know, in these anti-utopian times, it's hard to imagine the degree of social unrest that took place in these years coming out of World War One. The upheavals, obviously there were revolutions and attempts at having workers' councils run society in various places in the heart of Europe. But in a country like Britain, what kind of unrest was seen and how did those in power impose austerity given that this was a population that had won universal male suffrage in 1918 and female suffrage came a decade later, you know, not likely a population that would be voting for the policies of austerity.
That's really the genius of technocracy, right? It's the capacity to say in a moment in which, as you well mentioned, there was what was called at the time a strikeomania. Everyone was on strike. And it was not just about strikes. It was also about constructive proposals, right? There were a lot of understanding that we could nationalize coal and run it through workers' self-management. There was the understanding, the Ministry of Reconstruction had very visionary understanding of what was also the role of women in society. So creating summer homes where children could be reared in common, creating a permanent education for all adults as a right. So all of things that still today are unseen were being really thought about and put into practice with the building guilds, etc., etc. One can read the details of this in the first part of my book. But what you mentioned is the most important thing is how is it that technocrats were able to succeed. And I would say, again, through both coercion and consensus building. Coercion, very simply, through the fact that the Bank of England, that at the time was being questioned as a technocratic and privately owned body, so many were actually asking for the nationalization of the Bank of England. The Bank of England was able to increase interest rates in a very violent way in the spring of 1920, to the point that just a few months after, the unemployment rate had skyrocketed to over 10%, and people started slowly losing bargaining power, right? So the whole class balance that was favorable to the workers in that historical moment completely reverted to being very unfavorable to the worker. Of course, unemployment rates are the strongest disciplinary mechanism in a capitalist society, right? It's what Marx called the reserve army of labor. You constantly have people there ready to take another person's job if this other person is complaining for his or her working conditions. So unemployment was a key element in Great Britain, actually, and the fact that actually I have historical data in the book that show that once monetary austerity hit with high interest rates and unemployment skyrocketed, immediately after strikes basically were repressed. There were no more strikes around, and also the unionization rate really diminished very, very dramatically. So that was the coercive element, of course, and you take it with the fact that the Geddes Acts was actually a bigger cut in social expenditures than what happened with Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher, in the 80s. So the Geddes Act was actually of 1922, and we see how all of the welfare programs that had been won just a couple of years before were basically completely decapitated. There's the coercive element, but there's also the consensus building element. And the consensus building element is all about convincing people that technocrats have the right to be in power because they know the science and people instead are ignorant. And this is a fundamental element of our society still today. We trust the economists in thinking that they know better than us what is good for the economy. If you look at the records instead, which is what I do, I went in the archives and checked out like what the in-house economists of the British Treasury and the Bank of England were saying. If you check it out, you realize that what they were doing was pure class warfare against the British citizens. They were saying inflation is the fault of the workers, budgetary issue is the fault of the worker. What we need to do is impose abstinence. Literally, they say hard work and abstinence. How do we do that? Again, we privatize, we deregulate, we make sure that the rate of exploitation increases. So it's very interesting to note the disconnect between the rhetoric of the objective scholar who knows better than others and their actual policy advice and value judgment that are part and parcel of their economic models, which is all about actually pointing the finger at the supposed culprit of the economic crisis, which clearly is the worker. So this is what I try to show, is that if you focus on their actual models and the content of their models, again, models that are meant to expel labor from the picture and instead point the finger only to the importance of the entrepreneur as the heart of the economic success, and their policies, we realize that there's nothing objective and neutral about this science, that it's a science that is very much imbued with classist notions and solutions and recipes that we should be very much aware of.
And yet, while that may have seemed much more transparent in that time to people, that ideological appeal to these sort of simple notions of thriftiness, you know, people shouldn't be profligate, they should save their money, they should work hard. If they don't, they're the problem. Certainly has an enormous amount of ideological power, certainly that we can see in our day.
Completely. I think what's interesting is to note that a lot of, the values that we have internalized since we are very little are very connected to the type of economic theories that the that economists help expand and diffuse. And this is a very strong one, is the idea that, you know, actually it's through saving, through individual saving, that wealth is being produced. And again, this is a typical shift from the idea that our economic system is based on class suppression and antagonism between classes, and that actually wealth comes from the unpaid portion of the workday that the workers give to their bosses. And this is the structural definition of exploitation, by saying that actually wealth, the wealth we see around us, is the outcome of literally unpaid labor time. This narrative was completely substituted with another framework, which is then the emergence of the neoclassical framework, or what you can call the mainstream framework, that again still dominates today, that told you no, workers are just inputs in a production process that are actually there thanks to the fact that the saver investor have saved enough, have abstained enough to be able to hire them. So you see what's interesting here is that this explanation has a huge political consequence, because it's telling you not only that workers are dependent and they are passive cogs in the production process, but also that those who are the entrepreneurs, who are the wealthy, are there because they deserve it. So of course, meritocracy is a fundamental element in the support of austerity policies, by saying, of course, the state should protect and incentivize those who are better than others, those who we should all thank for the fact that they are there to help us all. And it kills the idea that actually our capitalist economy is based on conflict, and there's clear losers who are the majority and very few winners. This idea is substituted with the supposed harmonic, right? It's a harmonious system. We're all benefiting if we act rationally, supposedly, right? There's no classes, there's only individuals. There's no labor, it's only about saving. This type of change in the mindset deeply affects public debate and our moral sentiments towards this world. And I think it's only by exposing how this came about exactly to counter the incredible dynamism of democratic alternatives that were emerging, that we can see how biased they are in favor of a system that is actually, you know, guilty of the fact that even in the United States today, one out of six children are living in dire poverty. The 42 million people that are going to get cut out of food stamps as we speak, these are majority workers and children. This is clearly a system that is not operating for the logic of need of the people, but has completely different bottom line that we can expose if we look at how powerfully it needs to be protected by alternatives.
And as you've just touched on, you write that to understand modern economics, we really need to understand this moment, this sort of crucible of social unrest and alternatives to capitalism following World War I, and locate the formation of modern economics as we know it in the counter-revolution, I guess you could say, the reaction to that. And I wanted to ask you, at that period, how did a consensus emerge from economists and other experts who would shore up the capitalist order, a consensus of austerity that was imposed on countries like on Britain and on Italy? How did that consensus take shape?
I would say that in that moment, there was an effort to bring all of these technocrats together and to unite. And actually, in my book, I have a whole chapter about these first international financial conferences that had government officials with economic experts and professors come together, of course, excluding labor representatives explicitly, by saying that they were coming together and building this new doctrine that was, for them, should have had been powerful, just as the Justinian Code had been powerful in giving the foundation for Roman law and the Western legal system. So it was actually a very obvious effort. And here, I think, is what is hopefully the emancipatory insight of this book, is not to depress people, but to actually understand that the current state of affairs is the outcome not of any natural and spontaneous process, unlike they want to make us think, right, that we are an economic system that represents really who we are deeply as human beings. But actually, there's nothing spontaneous. But there's actually the opposite is the case, that there's a constant effort of our states, our governments, our central banks, all of the institutions that make up the capitalist state to enforce and protect the capital order. And this is very active. That's why austerity is not just, you know, this is very important. Austerity is not less state, more market, right? The idea that actually the state is stepping back to let the market be. This is a very ideological understanding of austerity because it presumes, again, that austerity is just letting the normal state of affairs develop and flourish. The opposite is the case. There was a very big effort, as you can see in that time, for these technocrats to come together and to advise government officials and technocratic bodies like the central bank to act in a specific way that would actually refurbish the quote-unquote healthy power relations between labor and capital, right? They had to intervene to tie the hands of organized labor, and they made it. But they did put so much effort into this, and that's why there's such a big amount of technical literature, but also a lot of, you know, newspaper articles that were being diffused, ways to get the public to accept austerity as the new dogma moving forward.
Political economist Clara Matei is my guest. We're talking about the capital order, how economists invented austerity and paved the way to fascism. This is Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. So you spoke about how these policies, these new notions around austerity were imposed on people in the UK, in Britain, workers who were organizing, going on strike, having political strikes, thinking about how to organize society differently beyond capitalism. This also took place in Italy, which was one of the centers of revolutionary fervor. And then, of course, in 1922, Mussolini comes to power. Can you talk about how austerity was imposed in this incredibly intense series of years in Italy, what the stakes were for the workers and for the Italian state?
You know, the book is dedicated to Gianfranco Mattei, who's my great uncle. He was a chemist, a young chemist of age 26, who was tortured and extensively in Via Tasso, which was the prison where the Nazi fascist occupation 1944 was perpetuating its violence against the partisans. And he killed himself not to speak against his comrades. And this was, you know, the end of a long fascist regime that had began in 1922 when Mussolini was called actually to power by the king to resolve a political crisis, right? So that what is interesting in the Italian case is that you see the alliance between liberals and fascists in the name of supporting the capital order and getting the workers out of the factories back into their condition of wage workers who are structurally exploited. So it's really interesting here to see that Mussolini, and this is why this book is ultimately also an account, a different account of the importance of the economic agenda to understand the fascist dictatorship. I would claim that Mussolini would not have come into power and maintained its power and become a full-blown dictatorship without the both intellectual and material support of not only the domestic bourgeoisie, the liberal domestic bourgeoisie, but also of international financiers and investors that profess liberalism. You know, the Bank of England, Montagu Norman, the head of the Bank of England, was writing a letter to Jack Morgan Chase, the head of the Bank of Morgan, that still today is the biggest bank in the world, Chase Bank, who was saying, you know, Mussolini was just the right man at a critical moment. We needed Mussolini in order to impose those measures that allowed for profits to grow, investment to continue, and workers to stop striking. So there's a clear alliance between fascists and liberals and the support for a dictator that was, again, the man who was capable of being determined enough to implement the austerity trinity and successfully get workers to accept the capital order once again. This is a story that is rarely talked about because we like to want to see fascism in opposition to capitalism, right? And this is why the a lot of history books are misleading. You know, they focus on how fascism was totalitarianism, but fail to tell you that fascism was at the time the best suited government for a capitalist system that was crumbling and needed to be protected and brought back on its trajectory of fulfilling the prerogative of private capital holders. And this is a part of the story that I tried to tell, is how Mussolini brought to his cabinet very, very famous and prestigious economic professors that again were cultivating and expanding the tradition of neoclassical economics that in Italy at that time was still a marginal, it was still a minority view. And these economists were fighting a political battle in academia to suppress historical Marx in schools, and at the same time were fighting the political battle by imposing austerity with Benito Mussolini. So I do think that this story is helpful to reread the history of fascism, but also to have a more critical understanding of what liberalism, European liberalism, was about. Again, it was about protecting the capital order. And this is the story that we see historically repeat itself. You know, we can remind ourselves of Augusto Pinochet in Chile in 1973, same story, the right man who was able to get support from the CIA and the Chicago School of Economics to implement heavy austerity on the Chilean people, and many other cases, Suharto in Indonesia. There's a sway of examples that repeat the same standard story of the big alliance between the ruling classes of different political creed in favor of austerity, and who was able to do that was the man of the hour.
Well, looking then at this period, though, following World War I that you've been describing, of upheaval and then a consensus, whether in, you know, a parliamentary democracy like Britain or a fascist state like Mussolini's Italy, a consensus about austerity and the imposition of austerity. In looking at that time and what came out of it, are you able to quantify the success of austerity, that is, as a class project, not as a narrow technical fix to economic crisis, but as this class project? If you look at statistics for how hard workers were working compared to their levels of compensation or any other quantitative metrics?
Yes, absolutely. So in chapter 9 of the book, I tried to give some data points, and you see how effectively the rate of exploitation actually went up. And what the rate of exploitation is basically it's a ratio between the share of GDP that goes to capital with respect to this share of GDP that goes to labor. And what you see is, again, that the resources that are produced by workers are taking more than ever away from them in terms of also lower wages and being skewed in terms of the capitalist class, right? So you can measure in how much of the pie that is being produced by workers is actually kept to the workers or instead given up to their bosses. So you can measure that. You can measure also the fact that, you know, inequality increased, poverty increased, all the labor laws protecting labor rights were diminished in Italy. You know, again, strikes were made illegal, and so were unions, except for the fascist union. You can see wages going down, social services being depleted. So there's a whole bunch of measures that can really show how, yes, austerity, the austerity recipe was applied, and was applied in a way that did give the fruits that were expected in terms of restabilizing the proper class relations in favor of the capitalist class. I say proper, of course, in quotes.
I'm joined by Clara Mate. She's an economist and president of the Forum for Real Economic Emancipation and the author of The Capital Order: How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. So you spoke a few minutes ago about Pinochet's Chile, bringing things, the story, much closer to the present. And I wanted to ask you about the relationship of austerity to the neoliberal era of capitalism, which is usually dated to the 1970s, the coup against Salvador Allende and the imposition of military dictatorship by Pinochet with the advising of part of the economics profession in the United States is often flagged as a pivotal point in the emergence of neoliberalism. Neoliberalism has also been defined as a kind of class war from above. How do you understand austerity's relationship to neoliberalism? Because you are arguing that it long precedes it.
Yes, thank you. This, I think, is a crucial point, is to show how historical analysis can open us to deeper-seated characteristics of our capitalist economic system. I think it's reductive to see austerity as a feature of neoliberalism. Austerity is actually a feature of capitalism per se. And this is important because it avoids this idealization, you know, of a supposed golden epoch of capitalism, which was the one that supposedly came after the Second World War, right? The years between 1950s and 1970, as those years in which we could see a capitalism with a humane face. What I look at is, of course, the 1920s, but you can see the patterns of the austerity rhetoric and the way economists understand and thus shape the economy in continuity, even after the Second World War. And this is, of course, is considered almost heretical by even a left that wants to depict neoliberalism as the problem and not capitalism per se as a problem, right? And what I try to show, and I'm writing a second book right now, actually, exactly on the Keynesian moment, right? The post-Second World War moment, we see that the same constraints were in place. You could not have a successful capitalist economy, high productivity, without being able to discipline workers into accepting the quite the usual rhetoric of austerity. So that is part of the plan, is also to kind of broaden up the critique and look deeper and say, you know, neoliberalism is a very accelerated and harsh expression of this austerity narrative and policies that preceded it by far. And I think what we see today is, again, with the current authoritarian turn in many countries in the world, we do see just a ever more evident realization of this profound truth that I tried to disclose by looking at the 1920s.
Well, I'd like to ask you about that. So the enduring legacy of austerity, which you say is really a feature of capitalism, and at the same time, the way that the period that you look at in The Capital Order following World War One, how in a sense austerity became, through a great deal of violent imposition, became this common sense that we're not supposed to question, that this is just the way that economics works, and if there's a problem, in comes austerity to fix it. When you look at the United States, how do you understand the legacy of those times on this society, how it has been shaped? Obviously, you mentioned that we're seeing an authoritarian state different than others in the past, but obviously, both under Democrats and Republicans, we have had this economic order. How would you characterize the lasting legacy of austerity in the United States bringing us to the present?
We clearly see the profound points of unity between the Democratic and the Republican Party in espousing austerity measures as just, again, objective, rational policies. And this, you know, we saw that actually child poverty rate went up dramatically under the Biden administration when there was a failure to maintain certain child credits in operation. And we see today with the government shutdown and the fact that we have over 1.4 million workers that are now have missed their paycheck and are having to decide whether they're going to put food on the table or pay for rent. These are very clear expressions of the violence of our economic system. So I think this is the point, is to say we can't point our finger to one exceptionally bad individual, right? It's too easy to point the finger to against a Trump or a Milei, a Giorgia Meloni, all of these individuals that are now, yes, at the head of our governments. The point is deeper. These individuals are just the expression of a much deeper role that the capitalist state plays in order to secure a capitalist economy. Because again, if the state were to give social benefits to people, were to secure decent living conditions for people, maybe people would find a space in their life to organize, to think more critically, to come together, to find out whether there are better alternatives to this unjust economic system. So the capitalist state needs to keep people under constant pressure of having to think about paying their bills, just the basic essentials to live a life. And we know that, of course, the criminalization of poverty goes together hand in hand with austerity, because that's, again, like a way to discipline workers. You need to discipline workers so that they do not have the time or the energy to think outside the box. And all they have the time to do is to barely think about surviving. So this is part of what we get in a system that is fundamentally anti-democratic, right? The fact that America is the greatest democracy in the world clearly fails if we look at the economic conditions in which this supposed democracy stands. We have now one of the wealthiest men in the world telling 1 out of 8 Americans that they will not receive enough to eat the next month. So we are really in a situation in which the extreme violence is being manifested. And of course, this comes with the fact that the American state is constantly financing very costly wars and ethnic cleansing around the globe. This is a reality that needs to be, I think, right now more than ever questioned. I think people are ready to question it. The Forum for Real Economic Emancipation, you can check us out at freefreeforum.org, that is based here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I'm currently based, is an attempt to bring together people who are fed up, people who know what the economy is like because they live it on their skins, and are curious and interested to think about alternatives that are concrete and use knowledge as the first empowering tool. So here in Tulsa, I hope we are building a pilot project of economic emancipation, right? The Real Economic Emancipation Project, to say how can knowledge of a different type, not of the one that often, unfortunately, students study at the university, but of a type that is truly critical and historical and concrete, help as a tool to rethink the very foundation of our social economic system and see how we can escape austerity. I think it is possible, again, by thinking that austerity is such a big effort from the part of the elite. This means that if we also put effort in getting together, organizing, and providing spaces for people to actually be able to think critically, I think this is the first step. So I hope people can join us. It's also an international movement. We have a YouTube channel at freefreeforum.org.
I wanted to end by asking you about central banks. So one of the things that you write about in the Capital Order is when this consensus was formulated of economists in the post-World War I period who shaped this notion of austerity, central banks played a key role. And in the United States, I think some of this has gotten kind of fuzzy because people have a deep suspicion, and rightly so, of what Donald Trump does. And so there's an argument that a politician like Trump should not mess with a central bank, not mess with the Federal Reserve, that there should be independence from elected officials. Can you just talk about how that emerged as such a central concern and how you think those of us who should be critical of the whole project of austerity and of capitalism more broadly should think about the role of central banks and their independence?
Central bank independence as a very concept emerged historically exactly in a moment in which the gold standard had come into pieces and governments had shown during the First World War how much more room there was to actually, you know, print money and borrow in order to fulfill people's basic needs, in order to pay for schools and for unemployment benefits and for housing. And it was in this moment in which, again, the orthodoxy had shattered because of the war experience that people were saying, well, you know, you showed us that it's possible to pay for the war, that the money is there. No one's going to believe you if you tell us that now there's no money available, right? This is exactly when people started saying, we want to participate in decisions about monetary policies. We want it to be actually about public debate. We want to nationalize the central banks. We want to be in charge. And the very most important move of the technocrats at that time, from the financial conferences to the domestic debates, was all about securing independence of the central bank. The idea that these technocratic bodies should not be interfered with, should not be liable to democratic scrutiny, becomes key. And it's also the key element, by the way, with the Fed, right? And actually, you know, Ralph Hawtrey, a protagonist of my book, said it very well. He said, central banks should never explain, never regret, never apologize, saying, you know, we do need to shield ourselves from demands of greater redistribution amongst people. We are the only ones that can act in favor of defeating inflation, right? And in favor of defeating inflation means we are the ones who can increase interest rates and have the workers suffer. And of course, we can only do this if we decide without them interfering, because they would not allow us otherwise to implement such a hard dosage of austerity that would in fact make their life miserable. So this is really important. And you know, from Britain, they start exporting central bank independence in the rest of the world, in India, in Brazil, in Latin America. So these technocrats were actually, you know, again, it's a very clear way in which you maintain control over the global south that has a lot of the resources we need to continue accumulating capital in the north. Central bank independence really means shielding from democratic scrutiny and maintaining the foundation for an economy that is non-democratic by definition. Now, clearly, this whole thing with Donald Trump is showing how Donald Trump himself has no interest in politicizing monetary policy in favor of people, right? So it's a fake opposition here. Right? It's a debate amongst elites that have taken for granted that anyway, democratizing monetary decisions is out of the picture, again, showing how successful the decades of austerity have been in making this the default situation in which people anyway are excluded.
Clara Mate, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Clara Mate is author of The Capital Order, How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. She's professor of economics at the University of Tulsa and president of the Forum for Real Economic Emancipation. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.